Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. This year, Democracy Now! Turns 25 years old. That's right, 25 years of bringing you the voices and stories you won't hear in the corporate media. Democracy Now! Has always refused to take government or corporate funding because nothing is more important to us than our editorial independence. Nothing is more important to us than telling you the truth. But that means we rely on you, our audience, for support. Please visit democracynow.org right now and make your $25 contribution in honor of our 25th anniversary and help us stay on air for another 25 years and then another 25 after that. Thank you so much. And remember, wearing a mask is an act of love. Wearing two is even better. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
HB 531 is textbook voter suppression. This bill reduces, restricts, and limits every single aspect of our elections.
Voting rights are under attack. The Georgia House has passed a sweeping bill to make it harder to vote. This comes as Republican lawmakers in 43 states have introduced over 250 bills to restrict voting access. And today, the Supreme Court considers gutting the Voting Rights Act even more. We'll speak with Ari Berman of Mother Jones. Then as the rollout of Johnson & Johnson vaccines begin today, we look at the racial vaccination gap. Black Americans are not only twice as likely to die of COVID-19 as white Americans, but also dying at rates similar to those of white Americans who are 10 years older. We'll speak with Dr. Oni Blackstone about her call to lower the age cutoff for vaccine eligibility for Black Americans. Then, as the pandemic raged, abortion access nearly flickered out.
Abortion access was in crisis before the pandemic hit. And what we've seen over the past year is the collision of a deadly pandemic with many years' worth of state laws aimed at making access to abortion as difficult as possible. And so the COVID pandemic, in many ways, has offered us a preview of what it will be like when the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade.
We'll speak to investigative journalist Amy Littlefield. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Governors around the United States have begun rolling back restrictions aimed at slowing the spread of COVID-19, even as the United States recorded another 58,000 new infections and 1,500 COVID-19 deaths Monday. Daily cases are down from January's record highs, but have plateaued at rates comparable with last summer's peak. The Centers for Disease Control Director, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, warned Monday steps to reopen public spaces may be coming too soon.
We cannot be resigned to 70,000 cases a day, 2,000 daily deaths.
Los Angeles County has begun vaccinating all school staff and is planning on reopening elementary schools and preschools by April 9th. Meanwhile, children in Chicago returned to in-person classes Monday for the first time in nearly a year. Former President Donald Trump and Melania Trump were secretly vaccinated against COVID-19 in January before leaving the White House. That's according to the New York Times, CNN, and other outlets who report that Trumps did not want to alienate supporters in the anti-vaccine movement by broadcasting images of their inoculations. About one in five U.S. residents over the age of 18 have been vaccinated, and the pace of inoculations is set to pick up with the first shots of Johnson & Johnson's single-dose COVID-19 vaccine due to be administered today. Also today, the Biden administration's announcing it secured a deal to have the pharmaceutical giant Merck produce shots of Johnson & Johnson's vaccine in a move that could sharply boost supply. The World Health Organization warned Monday the number of new coronavirus infections is rising worldwide for the first time in 7 weeks. In Peru, a second wave of COVID-19 cases and death has spawned shortages of bottled oxygen, leading to long lines and soaring prices for limited supplies. In West Africa, Ivory Coast and Ghana have begun administering shots of the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine purchased under COVAX, the UN-backed initiative. Slovakia has become the second European Union country after Hungary to approve shots of Russia's Sputnik V vaccine. Slovakia has one of the worst COVID-19 death rates in the world. In Brussels, European Commission officials announced plans to issue certificates known as digital green passes to allow vaccinated people to travel more freely. The United Nations is warning 400,000 Yemeni children under the age of 5 could die from acute malnutrition this year as the coronavirus pandemic and a Saudi-led war on Houthi rebels compounds the world's worst humanitarian crisis. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said Monday a donors' conference netted just $1.7 billion for humanitarian relief in Yemen, less than half the $3.8 billion needed to avert widespread famine.
Today, reducing aid is a death sentence for entire families. With the war raging, Yemen's children are paying the price.
The UN says about half of Yemen's population of 29 people is going hungry. Last month, President Biden pledged to end U.S. support for the Saudi-led war in Yemen, which began 6 years ago under President Obama. But the U.S. has refused to sanction Saudi Arabia's Minister of Defense, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, over the war in Yemen, and after he approved the assassination of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. State Department spokesperson Ned Price said Monday the administration is looking forward, not backward, on U.S.-Saudi relations.
We are very focused on future conduct, and that is part of why we have cast this not as a rupture, but a recalibration.
President Biden is suffering major blowback for not sanctioning Mohammed bin Salman. The Senate has confirmed Miguel Cardona to become Secretary of Education. Cardona became Connecticut's youngest school principal at age 28. He's Puerto Rican and grew up in public housing. Meanwhile, the Senate Judiciary Committee voted 15-7 Monday to recommend Judge Merrick Garland be confirmed as Attorney General, setting up a vote by the full Senate. Senators are debating last-minute changes to a $1.9 trillion coronavirus stimulus bill approved by the House and are expected to begin debate as early as midweek. Democratic lawmakers have introduced a wealth tax on ultra-millionaires and billionaires to help fund President Biden's Build Back Better agenda. Co-sponsor Senator Elizabeth Warren said Monday the wealth tax would help reverse massive inequality that's only gotten worse during the pandemic.
We have watched the wealth of the billionaire class in America increase by more than $1 trillion over the last year. A 2-cent wealth tax would just help level the playing field a little bit.
The Department of Justice is appealing a ruling by a federal judge in Texas that puts millions of U.S. residents at risk of eviction. Last week, U.S. District Judge John Barker, a Trump appointee, ruled an order from the Centers for Disease Control temporarily ending evictions during the pandemic is unconstitutional. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau says more than 2 million people are more than 3 months behind on rent and could face eviction if and when the moratorium is lifted. President Biden has voiced support for Amazon workers in Alabama who are voting on whether to form a union. Biden posted this message to Twitter Sunday evening.
Unions lift up workers, both union and non-union, and especially black and brown workers. I've made it clear when I was running that my administration's policy would be to support unions organizing and the right to collectively bargain.
Some 6,000 Amazon workers in Alabama have until the end of the month to cast ballots in what could become the first successful union drive at a U.S. Amazon warehouse. Go to democracynow.org to see our interview with the Amazon workers. In immigration news, the Biden administration's giving asylum-seeking parents separated from their children by Trump the opportunity to decide if they want to reunite with their children on U.S. soil or in their country of origin. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, who's heading Biden's Family Reunification Task Force, said Monday the policy was, quote, the most powerful and heartbreaking example of the cruelty that preceded this administration, he said. Mayorkas said the government will explore legal pathways to allow parents who choose to return to the U.S. to be with their kids to remain in the country. While immigrant justice advocates celebrated the move, many have vowed to keep fighting until Biden abolishes the detention of all asylum-seeking families. Calls to boycott Goya Foods continue to grow after the company's CEO, Robert Inanue, falsely claimed Donald Trump had won the presidential election. Inanue gave an introductory speech for Trump Sunday at the Conservative Political Action Conference, or CPAC, in Florida.
My biggest honor today is going to be that I think we're going to be on the same stage as, in my opinion, the real, the legitimate, and the still actual President of the United States, Donald J. Trump.
In response, the president of the League of United Latin American Citizens, or LULAC, Domingo Garcia, told CNN, quote, when you put out lies to the community, there are consequences, and there are going to be ramifications for your product, he said. In northwestern Nigeria, officials say nearly 300 girls who were kidnapped from a boarding school in Zamfara State last week have been released and are now safe. Their release reportedly follows negotiations between government officials and the kidnappers. It's not known if the abductors received ransom payments. In France, a court in Paris has found former President Nicolas Sarkozy guilty of corruption charges, sentencing him to at least a year in prison for trying to bribe a judge in 2014. He's the second French president in the modern era to be convicted of a crime. Sarkozy will remain free as he appeals his case, a process that could take years. On Capitol Hill, Democratic lawmakers are beginning debate on two separate bills to protect voting rights. If enacted, H.R. 1, the For the People Act, and the John R. Lewis Voting Rights Act would bring some of the most sweeping changes to U.S. election law in generations. Meanwhile, the Georgia State House voted along party lines Monday to pass an overhaul of the state's election laws, requiring ID for absentee voting, curbing ballot drop boxes, and limiting weekend early voting hours. Georgia Democrats blasted the law as an effort to roll back civil rights. We'll have more on the story later in the broadcast. A warning to our audience. The story contains descriptions of sexual harassment. In New York, a third woman's accused Governor Andrew Cuomo of sexual harassment. Anna Ruck detailed her experience in an interview with the New York Times, saying she met Cuomo at her friend's wedding reception in 2019, where he reportedly grabbed her lower back, put his hands on her cheeks, and loudly asked if he could kiss her. She said, I was so confused and shocked and embarrassed, Ruck told the New York Times. Her story was corroborated by a friend who witnessed the interaction, as well as photographs from the event. Governor Cuomo briefly addressed allegations made by two former aides in a statement Sunday night, saying his actions had been misinterpreted. On Monday, Democratic Congresswoman Kathleen Rice of New York tweeted, quote, the time has come. The governor must resign. And in Australia, eight youth climate activists and a nun have filed a landmark class action lawsuit that could force the Australian federal government to stop approving new fossil fuel projects. The suit was filed in response to a proposal by a coal corporation to extend its mine in North New South Wales. 16-year-old climate justice advocate Anjali Sharma is the lead plaintiff in the suit.
This is a crisis that disproportionately affects people of colour, young people, and marginalised people around the world. So yes, I'm terrified. I'm terrified about hearing the Pacific Islands sink into the sea. I'm terrified about hearing the increasing prevalence of natural disasters like bushfires and droughts and floods.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, in Georgia, the Republican-led House passed a sweeping bill Monday to make it harder to vote, in a move aimed at preventing Democrats from winning future elections. Republican lawmakers introduced the legislation after record voter turnout led to Joe Biden beating Donald Trump in November and Democrats Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff winning runoff elections in January, giving Democrats control of the U.S. Senate. The Georgia bill limits access to absentee ballots, limits weekend early voting hours, curbs ballot drop boxes, among other provisions. On Monday, Georgia Democratic Congressmember Jasmine Clark blasted her Republican colleagues.
Men lie. Women lie. Numbers don't. The numbers are clear. HB 531 is textbook voter suppression. This bill reduces, restricts, and limits every single aspect of our elections. And make no mistake, while the suppressive actions of this bill will harm Black and brown voters, all voters, including the ones that support your team, will be affected. As we saw in the last election, undermining absentee voting cost Trump over 20,000 votes across the state. Add this to the fact that this bill is meant to placate the same crowd that believes the big lie of voter fraud, and they don't trust the Dominion voting machines anyway, you will find yourselves in a conundrum. This bill is cutting off your nose to spite your face. Instead of reducing, restricting, and limiting our elections, we should be in this chamber working to make voting more accessible.
That's Georgia Democratic State Representative Jasmine Clark. Across the United States, Republican lawmakers have introduced more than 250 bills in 43 states to restrict voting access. This comes as the Supreme Court is hearing a major case today about Arizona's election laws that could result in the further weakening of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, Democratic lawmakers are pushing two separate bills to protect voting rights, H.R. 1, the For the People Act, and the John R. Lewis Voting Rights Act. We go now to Ari Berman, author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America, reporter for Mother Jones, where his article in the March-April issue of the magazine is headlined, The Insurrection Was Put Down. The GOP plan for minority rule marches on. How Republicans are breaking democracy. Ari, explain.
Good morning, Amy. Well, we're seeing it all across the country, how Republicans are breaking democracy. They are weaponizing Trump's big lie to try to pass 250 new restrictions on voting in 43 states, which would be the biggest rollback of voting rights in decades. They are pushing extreme gerrymandering to try to keep power in the states and to try to take back the House in 2022. They are using the filibuster so that 41 GOP senators, representing just 21% of the country, can block everything from a $15 minimum wage to legislation to restore the Voting Rights Act. So over and over and over, we're seeing that the Republican Party has no interest in appealing to a majority of Americans. Instead, they are doubling down on anti-democratic tactics so they can get a minority of votes but wield a majority of power. And that's a very, very dangerous phenomenon for American democracy.
Well, Ari, I wanted to ask you, ironically, the pandemic helped to expand the voting accessibility for millions of Americans. And I think it was in part responsible for the huge turnout, especially the universal mail-in ballots and the extension of voting times. To what degree, what do you think are the key issues that folks who want to continue to expand ballot access should be focusing on right now in terms of the reforms that Republicans are or the rollbacks that Republicans are trying to institute?
That's absolutely right, Juan. I think one of the reasons we had such high voter turnout in November was because people had more options to vote than ever before. People could vote by mail in more states than ever before. People could vote early in person, and people could vote on election day like they traditionally do. And giving people all of those options really helped increase voter turnout. And that's exactly what Republicans want to roll back. They are trying to roll back the voting methods that they believe that Democrats use the most in 2020. So yes, they are targeting mail voting. They are trying to get rid of universal vote by mail. They are trying to restrict mail ballot drop boxes in states like Georgia. But they're also going after in-person voting, which goes to show you this has nothing to do with election integrity, because at the same time they're getting rid of mail voting, they're also trying to get rid of things like early voting that make it easier for people to vote no matter which party they represent. In Georgia, for example, trying to get rid of weekend voting and Sunday voting when black churches hold Souls to the Polls voter mobilization drives. Black voters in Georgia are 30% of the electorate, but made up 37% of Sunday voters. So this is really a new form of Jim Crow, because they are targeting the voting methods that were used the most by black voters in states like Georgia, that led to record turnout, that helped flip Georgia blue and elect two Democratic senators. And those very voting methods that led to higher turnout, those are the things that are on the chopping block right now.
And I wanted to ask you about the hearing for the Supreme Court today and oral arguments on a challenge to a pair of Arizona voting policies, again, that make it harder for people to vote. Could you talk about what those policies are and what the likelihood of the court's ruling on this?
The case centers around two restrictions on voting in Arizona, a restriction that throws out ballots if they're cast in the wrong precinct, even though those votes would still be valid for statewide offices, and a restriction on the collection of ballots. This disproportionately harms voters of color. Voters of color were twice as likely as white voters to have their votes thrown out for being cast in the wrong precinct. And voters of color, particularly Native American voters and Hispanic voters, are more likely to rely on ballot collection because they live in remote areas that don't have regular access to the mail. So they rely on people to drop their ballot off for them. The case is bigger than that, though. It's not just challenging two restrictions on voting in Arizona. It's really challenging the remaining parts of the Voting Rights Act. Remember, in 2013, the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act and ruled that states with a long history of discrimination no longer had to approve their voting changes with the federal government. But it left in place a part of the Voting Rights Act, Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, that applied nationwide that could challenge discriminatory voting laws after they were passed. Now the Supreme Court could weaken that part of the law as well, and that would make it functionally impossible for minority voters to get protection under the Voting Rights Act at a time when new voter suppression laws are proliferating around the country. And this is what's so dangerous. We need a strong Voting Rights Act more than ever right now, given the spread of voter suppression. But in fact, the Supreme Court may say that the Voting Rights Act is practically non-existent at a time when voter suppression is spreading all across the country.
Ari Berman, talk about the record of the Chief Justice John Roberts on this.
John Roberts has been trying to weaken the Voting Rights Act for over 40 years. When he was a young lawyer in the Reagan Justice Department, he led the fight to weaken Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which is the part of the Voting Rights Act that's at issue in this Arizona case. Then 30 years later, when he became Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, he gutted the Voting Rights Act and ruled that states like Georgia and Arizona don't have to approve their voting changes with the federal government anymore. Interestingly enough, he pointed to the remaining section of the Voting Rights Act as a reason to get rid of one section of it. Well, now they're trying to get rid of that other section that Roberts said was still relevant. So this was the plan all along, to try to weaken the Voting Rights Act step by step so that Republicans could pass even more egregious voter suppression efforts, so that voters of color can no longer look to the court and can no longer look to the Supreme Court for protection. And this would be a historic rollback of the country's most important voting rights law and a really radical transformation for the worse of American democracy.
Can you talk about the pushback, the movement organizing? I think of Stacey Abrams, I mean, voter rights leader in Georgia, who was just warning, we're talking about if there isn't federal legislation, state by state, deciding whether there's total whether there is this lack of access for voting for people of color. But she pointed out, until now, actually, Republicans have benefited from expanded access. It only recently turned around. Can you explain that?
Well, I think it's true. If you look at mail voting, for example, before 2020, mail voting was used by equal numbers in terms of Democrats and Republicans, or even more by Republicans in a lot of places like Georgia and Arizona, because Republican voters are older and more rural. So they rely on mail voting more than many Democrats do, who are younger and live in more urban areas. And so this attack on mail voting is incredibly short-sighted. You also look at early voting. Yes, Democrats used early voting in higher numbers than Republicans in a lot of states, but a lot of Republicans used early voting, too. In Georgia, in the January 5th runoff, it was the first time that Democrats outnumbered Republicans in early voting, meaning that Republicans outnumbered Democrats in early voting in every previous election in Georgia. And so there's going to be a tremendous amount of collateral damage here for Republicans. They're betting that they're going to disenfranchise more Democrats than Republicans. But there's no doubt about it that they're also going to disenfranchise some of their own voters. 1.3 million voters in Georgia used no-excuse absentee voting, which they want to get rid of. That includes 450,000 Republicans. If I'm a Republican official, I'm a little concerned about the fact that I'm trying to eliminate a method of voting that nearly 500,000 of my own voters used in the last election.
And Ari, I wanted to ask you, the Senate will have a full vote today on Merrick Garland's nomination for attorney general. He would be the one who would be defending and implementing the Voting Rights Act. Your thoughts in terms of Merrick Garland on this issue?
Well, I think the Biden Justice Department has signaled that it will be aggressive in enforcing the existing provisions of the Voting Rights Act, not just Merrick Garland, but they have nominated some extremely capable people in other positions of the Justice Department. Kristen Clark, who's a fantastic civil rights lawyer, would head the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division, which oversees the Voting Rights Act. Vanita Gupta, another fantastic civil rights lawyer, would be the number three person in the Justice Department. So I think the Biden administration has signaled they will be aggressive in enforcing the Voting Rights Act. The problem is the Voting Rights Act is weakened and could be weaker. And that's why it's so important that Democrats in Congress pass federal legislation protecting the right to vote. The For the People Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Act are two of the most important pieces of federal legislation for voting rights that we've seen since the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965. And I think if you just rely on conservative-dominated courts, it's going to be a very rough road for voting rights. But if they pass expansive federal legislation protecting the right to vote, it becomes a lot easier for voters to seek protection.
So finally, we just have 20 seconds, but Louis DeJoy, the major Republican donor who is postmaster general, what's happening with him and Biden, what control he has over what the mail service has to do with voting?
Well, Biden nominated three new members of the Post Office Board of Governors. The Board of Governors can remove Louis DeJoy. If these three nominees are confirmed, Biden would have a majority of postal governors who could remove DeJoy from office. So DeJoy's days are probably numbered. At the very least, there's going to be a lot of accountability for him that there wasn't. And more than likely, he is going to be removed at Postmaster General once Biden gets a majority of Postal Service governors.
We want to thank you so much for being with us. Ari Berman, author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. We'll link to your Mother Jones piece, headlined, The Insurrection Was Put Down, The GOP Plan for Minority Rule Marches On. Coming up, we speak to Dr. Oni Blackstock about her call to lower the age cutoff for vaccine eligibility for Black Americans. Stay with us.
I heard there was a rumor shed that COVID vaccines were unprepared or brewed to really censor and control you. Well, it goes like this, a fourth or fifth of people might have fought for this. They're thinking of opposing having new jobs. Have the new job, have the new job, have the new job, have the new job. Well, the science is strong and they've yielded proof. Won't grow scales or camel's hooves. They duly checked with trials and then approved them. It's biological warfare. They broke all records but still took care. So please do not refuse to have the new jab. Have the new jab.
The Marsh family singing, have the new jab. That's what many outside the United States call the vaccine, the shot, to the tune of Hallelujah by Leonard Cohen. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The U.S. vaccination campaign is getting a new boost today as the first Johnson & Johnson vaccines are administered. According to the White House, nearly 4 million doses of the single-shot vaccine will be initially given out. Johnson & Johnson's the third COVID vaccine to receive FDA emergency approval. Nearly 20% of adults in the United States have received at least one vaccine shot so far. But there is a wide racial gap in who's being vaccinated. While Black and Latinx communities have been hardest hit by the pandemic, rates of vaccination in communities of color are lower than largely white communities across the country. Data from the Centers for Disease Control shows just 5% of vaccines have gone to Black Americans, only 11% to Latinx recipients. This comes as life expectancy in the United States fell by a full year during the first 6 months of 2020, largely due to the pandemic. It's the largest drop since World War II. Life expectancy for Black Americans dropped by almost 3 years and 1.9 years for Latinx people. Some doctors are now calling on the CDC and states to give greater priority to communities of color in the vaccine rollout. Doctors Oni and Uche Blackstock are pushing to lower age cutoffs for African Americans. In a recent Washington Post op-ed, they write, Black Americans are twice as likely to die of COVID-19 as white Americans, but also dying at rates similar to those of white Americans who are 10 years older. They go on, moreover, racial inequalities are most striking at younger ages. For example, Black people ages 45 to 54 are 7 times more likely to die of COVID-19 than similarly aged white Americans. Dr. Oni Blackstock joins us now, primary care and HIV physician, founder and executive director of Health Justice. It's great to have you with us. A fascinating op-ed piece you write with your twin sister, also a doctor. Dr. Blackstock, lay out your argument. What age would you like to see Black Americans, the age cutoff for vaccines, and explain further why?
Oh, good morning, Amy, and thank you so much for having me on. You know, my sister and I were really compelled to write this op-ed because it appeared that these fixed age cutoffs that most states implemented did not take into account structural racism's toll on Black life expectancy, in addition to the impact of the pandemic on the life expectancy of Black people in this country. And, you know, we propose either removing or reducing the age cutoff for Black Americans. In Australia, for instance, they lowered the cutoff for Indigenous Australians to 55 when it was at 70 for non-Indigenous Australians. In Canada, they actually opened up eligibility to all individuals from Indigenous communities in order to increase uptake among Indigenous Canadians. And that has resulted in higher levels of vaccination in Indigenous communities as compared to the general population. So, you know, we haven't done exact modeling to say, you know, by what amount cutoffs should be reduced, but a reduction or a complete sort of removal of cutoffs for Black people as well as other people of color, you know, I think would go a long way towards addressing the vaccine inequities that we see.
And what kind of response are you getting to this?
Yeah, so I think, you know, many people are not necessarily familiar with some of the issues that we raise in the op-ed. I think some folks are familiar with, for instance, the ways in which redlining and other housing policies which were discriminatory have concentrated poverty in Black communities, have created really high levels of air pollution in Black communities, limited green space and healthy foods, you know, leading to poor health outcomes. You know, there's also weathering, which many people may not be familiar with, but this whole idea that living with the day-to-day impact of racism, discriminatory experiences, the cumulative socioeconomic disadvantage associated with racism, all of that actually has an impact on the body. It has a toll, a wear and tear effect that results in Black people actually getting many of these conditions, such as high blood pressure and diabetes, that are associated with worse COVID-19 outcomes, getting those at much younger ages than their white counterparts. So, you know, we've gotten, you know, not surprisingly, some pushback, but we've also gotten many people who support this and agree that a race-blind or colorblind approach to the vaccine rollout is only going to worsen racial inequities.
Dr. Blackstock, let's talk about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. There are a number of people who are concerned, you know, I hope I don't get that vaccine, they're saying, even though it is, you know, one shot, because they say that it's got lower efficacy. But can you explain why that actually is not a correct argument, given where it was tested in the time of the variants?
Right. So, you know, with the authorization of this now third shot for the novel coronavirus, it's very exciting. But I understand that sort of the messaging around the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, you know, hasn't really addressed people's concerns. The Johnson & Johnson vaccine was tested at a time where we saw the emergence of the variant that was first detected in South Africa. You know, there were other variants as well that were emerging that were more contagious and potentially more able to evade the vaccine-mediated immune response, and as such, showed a somewhat lower efficacy when it came to preventing overall disease and mild to moderate COVID-19 disease. This is in contrast to the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, which were tested before the emergence of these variants. What's really important to note is that all of these vaccines are highly effective in reducing the risk of severe COVID-19 and 100% effective in reducing the risk of hospitalizations and death from COVID-19, which are the outcomes that we really care the most about.
Let me ask you about the whole issue of vaccine hesitancy. Do you think that it would increase people's trust if there was actually more information about problems that maybe some people have? Millions of people have gotten the vaccine. Where are the databases that show maybe what the response is, the allergic response, the whole issue of blood clots, issues like Bell's palsy, others, that even if you talk more about problems, it might make people more confident that there is research going on that shows the effects of these vaccines, even the short-term effects, since we don't know the long-term effect, right? Because these are all so brand new. Mm-hmm.
Right. So there is a great deal of post-marketing surveillance being done by all of the vaccine makers. So that means once the vaccine has been authorized and rolled out, they are collecting data from many of the people, for instance, who continue to be in these clinical trials. But as well, we have applications such as the VSafe, which is a CDC app where people can enter any side effects that they have. So far, about 4 million people have entered the range of side effects that they've experienced from the vaccine into this app. And most notably, the CDC director, Rochelle Walensky, said at a press conference yesterday that most people have reported incredibly mild and short-lived side effects, and that serious side effects appear to be incredibly rare. So we want to make sure that folks are getting that information and are encouraged to take the vaccine and have their confidence in the vaccine increase.
Dr. Oney Blackstock, you and your twin sister Uche wrote a piece for JAMA. That JAMA journal, I was in our house from my entire growing up. My father used to read it all the time, the journal, the American Medical Association, so we called it PAJAMA. But anyway, earlier this year, you wrote a piece that was titled Serving the People, Body and Soul, Centering Black Communities to Achieve Health Justice. In it, you write, quote, if there was ever a moment to ask how we can re-envision what health justice means for Black communities, it's right now. And the response to that question must be both radical and revolutionary. We need to look no further than the health activism legacies of the Black Panther Party and the Young Lords. Both grassroots organizations rose to prominence in the mid to late 60s and, despite their short-lived success, made a tremendous impact through their activism, which centered on their community right to self-determination and to health. You're talking right now to one of the co-founders of the Young Lords, Juan Gonzalez. If you can talk about that effect, and then we'll get Juan commenting on it as well.
Yes, very super excited to be in conversation with one of the founding members of the Young Lords. My sister and I, again, felt very compelled and inspired to write this op-ed, really thinking about what the Black Panther Party and the Young Lords were able to do in terms of really showing the ways in which when communities that are most impacted, communities that are most burdened, are allowed to really have their concerns centered and are able to lead and develop, initiatives that really understand the ways in which the social conditions, now that we know are called the social determinants of health, how all of those impact health. So, for instance, I'm sure Juan Gonzalez was probably familiar and maybe involved in the Garbage Collective in East Harlem, recognizing the ways in which, poor sanitation conditions impact the health of communities. The Black Panther Party, for instance, sort of took up the initiative of sickle cell screenings in the Black community when that was a neglected area. And so we know that we have, so many assets and resources in the communities that are most impacted, and we need those communities to be able to lead. So, for instance, with the current pandemic, what would be so tremendous is to have grassroots and community-based organizations funded to do education and outreach, to navigate residents to vaccine appointments, to give vaccines themselves. And we know that, if the Young Lords and Black Panther Party were still as active, we would probably see them really involved in this work very wholeheartedly.
Juan, did you ever expect your organization, the Young Lords, to be cited in the Journal of the American Medical Association in a positive way?
Well, Amy, and certainly not 50 years after we were active in these kinds of health initiatives. And I apologize to Dr. Blackstock because we had a power outage here in New Jersey, so I missed a portion of this interview. But yes, I was the Minister of Education and Health with the Young Lords, so it was my responsibility to sort of develop and implement the health initiatives that we had, which included door-to-door lead poison testing for children in East Harlem and the South Bronx, tuberculosis testing, and also a campaign for community control of our local hospitals. I think one of the big reforms that occurred subsequent to our efforts was that the federal government did mandate municipal hospitals to have community advisory boards, not quite the community control we wanted of these health institutions, but at least community advisory boards that could inform the health professionals in terms of the needs of the community. And of course, we also always supported the unionization of hospital workers, which obviously became a very big movement throughout the 80s, 90s and into the new century. So I'm really heartened that the health professionals of today understand that we did play some kind of a role as young teenagers and radical activists in the late 60s and early 70s trying to create a better health system for America.
Yes, and your efforts were greatly appreciated, and it was really important for my sister and I to make sure that the name Young Lords and Black Panther Party appeared in such a journal.
Would you like to talk, Dr. Blackstock, respond to President Biden's response to AMLO, the president of Mexico, Andrés Manuel López Obrador? They had their virtual summit yesterday, Biden and López Obrador. And this is a reporter who was questioning White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki about the meeting Monday.
When the president of Mexico Mexico meets with President Biden a little bit later today. He's expected to ask if President Biden would consider sharing part of the U.S. coronavirus vaccine supply with his country. Is this something that President Biden is considering?
No. The president has made clear that he is focused on ensuring that vaccines are accessible to every American. That is our focus.
Dr. Blackstock, your response. You talk about what's equity in the United States. Can you talk about that writ large in the world?
Yes. So we're seeing, you know, many parallels to the situation here in the United States play out globally. Global vaccine equity is critically important. We know that we aren't safe until all of us is safe. So it is a moral and ethical issue in terms of the responsibility of higher income countries such as the United States to ensure that low and moderate income countries have access to the vaccine. But we also know that the virus, you know, knows no boundaries. You know, if we see that low and middle income countries continuing to have, you know, widespread transmission of COVID-19, we can see the emergence of more and more, you know, highly transmissible and potentially more deleterious variants that, again, could have an impact on Americans here, you know, people here in the United States. So we just have to realize the ways in which we are interconnected and that we need to not only prioritize, you know, Americans for vaccines, but ensure that, you know, all of our countries around the world, and particularly those that are low and middle income, you know, have the same access to the vaccine. The United States has bought, I think, or ordered about 1.3 billion doses of vaccine. That's enough to vaccinate, you know, the population several times over, right? And so there's obviously room to ensure lower resource countries also have access.
And Dr. Blackstock, I wanted to ask you about an increasingly contentious issue, which is the question of the reopening of public schools. There are obviously a growing debate. Many children, especially African-American and Latino children and poor children with poor internet access, have essentially lost a year of schooling. And the growing debate between the teachers' unions on the one hand, local government officials, and distinct groups of middle class parents who are still getting their children educated, many of them in private schools or even Catholic schools. I'm wondering your sense of how the road forward on this issue of the reopening of schools.
Yes, it has been a very controversial issue and very polarizing. What we do know, you know, I'm here in New York City, we do know that children can go to school safely if the appropriate preventive measures are taken. And so we need to ensure, obviously, that schools have the support to ensure that, you know, children are able to socially distance, they're able to mask, obviously hand hygiene. Ventilation is incredibly important, but that can be done pretty easily with opening windows, having box fans, and the like. And then, you know, contact tracing is obviously really important, as well as access to testing. We think that, you know, teachers should be obviously prioritized for vaccination, and we see a number of states doing that right now. And I think there's some of the challenges that we've seen with the school openings have been jurisdictions that have linked school openings to community sort of levels of the virus. But we've seen here in New York City that you can still have higher levels of the virus in the community while children are able to go to school safely. So I think the most important thing that needs to happen is that that districts are supported in being able to make whatever changes or modifications they need to make to their physical settings to ensure that both students and teachers are safe and that teachers are prioritized for vaccination.
Well, Dr. Arne Blackstock, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Primary care and HIV physician, founder and executive director of Health Justice. We'll link to your op-ed column with your twin sister, also a doctor. We'd love to meet your mother. Called Black Americans Should Face Lower Age Cutoffs to Qualify for a Vaccine. Your sister, Dr. Uche Blackstock. When we come back, as the pandemic raged, abortion access nearly flickered out. Stay with us.
Back through the years, I go wandering once again. Back to the seasons of my youth. I recall a box of rags that someone gave us, and how my mama put the rags to use. There were rags of many colors, but every piece was small, and I didn't have a coat, and it was way down in the fall. Mama sewed the rags together, so in every piece with love, she made my coat of many colors that I was so proud of. As she sewed, she told a story from the Bible she had read about a coat of many colors Joseph wore, and then she said, perhaps this coat will bring you good luck.
Coat of Many Colors by Dolly Parton. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show looking at how people have struggled to access abortion during the pandemic and how states have tried to use COVID to ban abortion as a non-essential service. Reporter Amy Littlefield writes in The Nation that many saw the pandemic as a, quote, dry run for the overturn of Roe v. Wade, the landmark Supreme Court case that legalized abortion and is now in greater peril than ever after the confirmation of Justice Amy Coney Barrett, unquote. Meanwhile, the pandemic's increased the demand for abortion funds and also for telemedicine abortion, which combines medication abortion, which uses pills to end a pregnancy, and telemedicine, which allows health providers to supervise the procedure remotely. For more, we are joined by investigative reporter Amy Littlefield, whose new piece in The Nation magazine is headlined as "The Pandemic Raged, Abortion Access Nearly Flickered Out." Amy, welcome back to Democracy Now!. Talk about Texas and what happened there during this pandemic and also just in the last weeks.
Texas, in the early weeks of the pandemic, sort of gave us a dress rehearsal for what it could look like when states try to ban abortion entirely, which I think many expect to happen when the Supreme Court, with its new Trump-appointed, you know, anti-choice majority, overturns or overhauls Roe v. Wade. What happened in Texas is that when the pandemic struck, state officials used that as a pretext to ban abortion as a non-essential service under the guise of preserving PPE. And this was immediately challenged in the courts. And as the legal battle went back and forth over a period of a month, access to abortion in the state switched on and off 8 times. And the abortion provider I spoke with, who was on the front lines of this at Planned Parenthood of Greater Texas, described a traumatizing situation where abortion clinic staff became, in her words, agents of the state's cruelty, repeatedly having to call patients, cancel their abortion appointments, and tell them they didn't know when they could reschedule. At times, patients would be sitting in the waiting room about to have their abortion, and the staff would have to come out and say, I'm sorry, we just got word that this ban is back in place. We're not going to be able to see you. And there was a massive migration of patients in the midst of this deadly pandemic who were forced to travel. Almost 1,000 patients in the month of April alone who sought care in other states. And if you think about that, you know, every time they have to stop at a rest area, every unnecessary encounter with medical staff along the way, that, you know, all is a potential infection risk. And so we saw how half a century worth of attempts to whittle away at abortion access really collided with a deadly pandemic in a way that was just devastating. I was really inspired by some of the feats of heroism, frankly, that abortion funds, which are groups that exist to try to raise money for people to pay for abortions they couldn't otherwise afford, you know, they moved mountains in order to get people to care. I mean, we're talking about people driving strangers for hours, flying with them on airplanes. We're talking about, you know, not just in Texas, but nationwide, people, you know, getting into cars with strangers and driving them through the South Dakota cornfields and through the Florida Everglades to get to their appointments. That's how hard these funds worked. And yet it still wasn't enough. And advocates in Texas told me they know that there are patients who are not able to get the care that they needed and who stayed pregnant against their will.
And Amy, what do you think the new Biden administration should do to improve access to abortion, especially in light of the even more conservative Supreme Court that exists today?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there's some low-hanging fruit that Biden has already indicated he's going to move on in terms of repealing the Trump administration's devastating policies, undermining abortion access. But there are two ways that President Biden could go further than his Democratic predecessors. And I think in this moment of crisis, that sort of action is demanded. And reproductive justice groups are watching very closely to see if Biden will, number one, repeal the longstanding restrictions on medication abortion access that are widely interpreted to require patients to go in person to a health center to get a pill, which is the first step in a medication abortion, and then they can take the rest of the medication home with them. Those longstanding federal requirements were put on hold temporarily, and they're now back in place thanks to the Supreme Court during the pandemic. Biden and his Food and Drug Administration could suspend those rules and overhaul them so that medication abortion can be picked up at a pharmacy or sent to patients from online pharmacies by mail, just like any other drug with that kind of safety record. The other really important policy, and where reproductive justice groups are watching closely to see if Biden will deliver on his promises, is the Hyde Amendment. This is a 45-year-old ban on federal funding for abortion. And, you know, when we talk about the disproportionate impact of the pandemic on people of color and Native people in this country, the Hyde Amendment, more than any other policy, has really shifted the burden of abortion access onto communities of color and low-income people. It prevents Medicaid recipients in most states from having their insurance cover their abortion, and it's really served as a de facto ban on abortion access. And so if Biden starts to put pressure on Congress to repeal the Hyde Amendment, which he indicated he would on the campaign trail, that would have a revolutionary impact on access in this country.
And Amy, you also found some examples where the pandemic actually eased access to abortion. Could you talk about that as well?
Right. So when the federal court in July put a hold on these restrictions on mifepristone, the first drug used in medication abortion, we saw digital abortion clinics spring up that were offering telehealth visits and sending abortions by mail. We saw the expansion of existing avenues for accessing those options because there was such a demand for it. We saw online pharmacies start to ship medication abortion kits, but these options are only available to patients in states that will allow it. And there are 18 states that have active bans on telemedicine abortion. Ohio actually, during the pandemic, decided to further restrict abortion access by requiring, by banning telemedicine abortion, you know, in the midst of a time where visiting a medical center could feel like a risk to many people. So we're really going to potentially see a deeper divide in terms of who's able to access abortion, depending on where you live and whether you have the money to get out of the place where you live.
Amy, I wanted to ask you about culture and reproductive rights. Last year, as multiple states moved to further restrict access to abortions during the pandemic, we reported on a powerful new dramatic film called Never Rarely, Sometimes Always that follows a 17-year-old girl as she travels from her small town in Pennsylvania to New York to get an abortion without having to notify her parents. The film is seen as a possible Oscar contender, but at least one Academy Award voter who opposes abortion said he won't be watching the film. Variety magazine reports that filmmaker Keith Merrill was asked by an awards publicist if he'd seen the film. He replied, "I received the screener, but as a Christian, the father of 8 children and 39 grandchildren and pro-life advocate, I have zero interest in watching a woman cross state lines so someone can murder her unborn child," unquote. Well, on Friday, the film's director, Eliza Hittman, posted Merrill's comment on Instagram and condemned the Oscars voting body, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, for being, quote, still so painfully monopolized by an old, white, puritanical male guard. She said, "I wonder how many other voters out there won't watch the film. Hashtag Oscars so puritanical." Can you end by responding to this?
You know what really grabs me about that quote, Amy, is the part where the anti-choice man invokes his children and grandchildren. You know, since we last spoke, I've become a parent myself, and nothing has made me more convinced of how high the stakes are in this debate than becoming a parent. It has been the most joyful experience of my life. I love my kid, and I got to choose when to have him. Maybe not the pandemic part, but the rest of it. And I would, you know, not wish this experience on anyone who has not fully opted in. It is glorious work. It is wonderful work, but it is hard work. And we have to stop seeing having children and having families as antithetical to having abortions, because we're talking about the same people at different moments in their lives, and nobody should be forced to do this against their will.
Well, Amy, you're giving us all a chance to cavil, because we got to show a picture of little Tully. Congratulations on your baby living through the first year of this pandemic. People can go to our last interview with you where you talked about what it was like to give birth in the face of what happened last year. And congratulations. We're going to link to your piece in The Nation. Amy Littlefield, an independent freelance journalist, formerly Democracy Now! Producer. That does it for our show. Happy birthday to Libby Rainey. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, Adriano Contreras. Special thanks to Julie Cruz, Rebecca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much.